WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. With the end of the Cold War, U.S. military sites across the country and around the world are being closed. One of the legacies of that era is toxic waste production and dumping from military installations. Seth Shulman has been investigating the practices and attitudes of the military towards the environment for 4 years. He found through visits to military sites and from reports obtained through the Freedom of Information Act that the military has been allowed to operate outside environmental laws and has created a serious environmental problem. In this country, more than 20,000 sites are suspected of being contaminated. The cost of cleanup is estimated to run into the hundreds of billions of dollars. Shulman's book is called The Threat at Home, Confronting the Toxic Legacy of the U.S. Military. Shulman's introduction to the seriousness of this problem began with a visit to the Rocky Mountain Arsenal, which is located outside Denver, Colorado. On the site are a number of holding basins containing toxic waste. The contents of basins A through E have been absorbed into the ground. I asked him to describe Basin F.
Basin F sits on a parcel of land that's 26 square miles. It's on the Rocky Mountain Arsenal, which is an Army facility. And this is a facility where they produced chemical weapons and disposed of the byproducts of that production dating back to World War II. And during my tour of the facility, I was driven along a road in the center of the Rocky Mountain Arsenal, where we went by on the right-hand side a series of dug-out, burnt-out pieces of land. And finally, across the road, we came to Basin F. They were lettered, Basin A, Basin B. These were pits, lagoons that they had dug over the years to dispose of the byproducts of mustard gas and nerve gas that they produced at the facility. And only the most recent one, Basin F, had been lined with asphalt. So by the time we got there, Basin F still contained its contents, which were a green, phosphorescent, slightly glowing, concentrated, toxic sludge. It was quite a disturbing sight, a lagoon, something on the order of 93 acres, basically a toxic lake.
Is there a cleanup on the books?
Well, again, you're talking about a site that many experts have called the most toxic square mile on Earth. There is a lot of debate about what to do about it. Since my visit, Basin F has been dredged into holding tanks, some of the dirt underneath the other lagoons I was speaking of has been piled into a mound on the facility. But this is just a prelude to a real cleanup. They think just this one site alone, a cleanup will cost on the order of $1 billion or possibly even more. This is an awful lot of money to spend, of course, and so it's not an easy answer. We have a lot of work yet to be done at this site, and this is one of the most one of the furthest along.
What are the toxic hazardous materials that are produced on a military base? And here I'm talking very generally, looking at military bases across the country.
Let's take just a simple example by way of trying to answer your question. The Pentagon buys roughly 200 million barrels of fuel oil a year. 200 million barrels. By my calculations, this is a stream of barrels that could wrap around the Earth five times. Enough oil, according to one estimate, to run the entire public transit system for more than a decade. This is a big, big enterprise. That's just oil use. Similarly, the military uses almost every kind of chemical. The Air Force Logistics Branch maintains some 53,000 jet engines. That's a huge fleet of engines. These engines, to maintain them, they use a lot of solvents to clean them off for maintenance purposes. The army makes a huge amount of munitions. They make bombs and artillery shells, and in the production of virtually all of this ammunition, there are toxic byproducts. In fact, every army ammunition plant in the country has polluted its land, and in many, many cases, the local groundwater as well.
Well, taken as a whole, then, looking at all the military bases, all the military installations, and then comparing that to industry, who's the worst offender?
Well, that's a really tough question. I've worked on that for a long time. You see a lot of different estimates, and as a journalist, it's tricky to pick your way through them. One thing that you see an awful lot is that the military's generation of toxic waste is greater than the top five multinational chemical companies combined. I was unable to definitively establish that. What I can tell you, though, is that the military produces something on the order of a ton of toxic waste every minute, and that no matter how you look at it, we're talking about one of the world's largest generators of toxics.
Now, why don't the environmental laws that apply to the civilian sector, the private sector, apply to military installations?
Well, to a large extent, we have seen, since World War II, we've seen the military be able to insulate itself from the environmental laws that came on the books. Now, it's you know, the more I've looked into it, the trickier it becomes in some respects. We saw in 1976, President Carter issued an executive order that said, in essence, that all federal facilities, including military facilities, would be bound by the same laws that private industry was bound by. Unfortunately, though, we never saw the kind of enforcement. And during the Reagan years, Reagan issued a different executive order that hampered the environmental protection's ability to enforce the law against another branch of the government, basically tied their hands. So without that enforcement, without that kind of oversight or accountability by a separate agency, we've seen the Pentagon, all the branches of the armed forces, essentially able to just hide behind the fences of their facility, maintain that they're responsible for the own mess that they're making, and also hide behind a veil of national security, maintaining that a lot of what they do for security reasons was secret, and denying access to people concerned about the environment, denying access to people, for instance, from the Environmental Protection Agency.
Much of the information in your book you obtained through the Freedom of Information Act. You mentioned the fact that a lot of this information is secret, and a lot of these sites are fenced up and people cannot get into them. Are you saying that the military is really covering up their toxic waste, or do they truly consider this material not hazardous, or not as hazardous as others might?
Well, let me first say that over the 4.5 years that I worked on this project, I've seen a dramatic change in the way the military views the problem. We've yet to see a lot of cleanup, but we are seeing a major change in the way that the problem is addressed. We went through a period of some 15 years or so, from the middle 1970s through the 1980s, where the private sector was ramping up, following a lot of the environmental laws that were coming onto the books. And meanwhile, right next door, the military was doing nothing of the kind. And in fact, during this time, there are dozens and dozens of cases where the military, when it discovered the extent of its problem, did try to cover it up, even when people on the base realized that contaminants in high numbers were threatening neighboring communities. We have a number of cases like that, and some of them I look at quite closely in the book. I hope that most of that is behind us now, and I can't say with any assurance that it is, but I will say that I think probably a lot of that active secrecy to cover up the extent of the problem that's behind us. And one of the reasons is that for the past 5 years or so, the Pentagon has been in a counting mode. They've been counting up how many sites they have, how bad the problem is. And as that information has begun to seep out to the public, some of the worst and most embarrassing facts about the situation have come forth, and it makes the need to cover up the information evaporate. Of course, also the end of the Cold War helps in this regard also to open it up.
I have a letter here from Thomas E. Baca, who's the Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense, and this is a letter about your book. He says that 7,000 of the sites that were cited in your book have been closed out, that their current environmental programs are making positive changes, which he says are too numerous to go in at this time in this particular letter. Does this really underscore what you're saying, which is that the Pentagon or the Defense Department is taking this issue seriously and taking steps to fix the problem?
Well, I have a lot of respect for Mr. Baca, but the section of the letter responding to my book that you just read is in error, basically. It's complicated. Let me try and explain it to you as I understand it. Over the past number of years, every year the Pentagon issues a list, an annual report of the Defense and Environmental Restoration Program, which gives a status report of how they're doing. Since I wrote the book, the very latest report has come out. Now, the report and most all of the information in my book rely completely, of course, on the military's own estimation of the problem. There is no other source. But this year, for the first time, they've begun to introduce this new category, which is called, if you notice what he said some 7,000 sites have been closed out.
Right.
It doesn't say cleaned up, it says closed out. If you look at the latest report, those 7,000 sites, by the way, have miraculously been closed out since the time my book was published. Actually, if you look at the very latest figures that he's drawing upon, we see that 372 remedial actions have been completed. 372. This is out of 17,660 sites that the military's investigated. It works out to being something on the order of 2%, which is what I said based on last year's figure.
Let me make sure I understand the language here, though. You're saying the word remedial actions. Does that mean
it's actually a cleanup? It can be anything from moving a bunch of barrels off of a site to setting up a water treatment facility. It can be a relatively minimal thing, or sometimes a relatively major thing. But only 372 have actually been completed to date. Only somewhat more than that are even underway at this point. Mostly what we've been seeing is what they call preliminary assessments and site investigations, where the military and its contractors go in to try and assess just how bad the problem is. And on the basis of that, sometimes the determination is made to put off the cleanup, or that a cleanup can wait or is not needed. And this they call now closing out a site. It means they're not going to do anything about it. Of course, in the absence of the kind of oversight and accountability that I'm talking about, I have a lot of concern about these 7,000 sites. Again, regardless, we're talking about tens of thousands of sites that, even by the military's own estimation today, need a cleanup, that they plan ultimately to clean up, but that they, you know, compare that number well over 10,000 to the 372 that have actually been addressed.
My guest today on Fresh Air is Seth Shulman, and his book is called The Threat at Home, and it's actually a study of the U.S. military's toxic environmental legacy. We're going to take a short break. This is Fresh Air. I'm speaking with writer Seth Shulman about his book called The Threat at Home, Confronting the Toxic Legacy of the U.S. Military. When talking about cleaning up toxic lakes, toxic runoffs, is this a solvable problem beyond putting in cement pools? Looking at today's technology, is it possible to truly clean up a toxic waste site?
The truth is, we're dealing with a military that is no stranger to technological wizardry when it comes to all sorts of endeavors, designing guided missiles that can hit very precise targets, you name it. But more than the technological side is the will and the public will and commitment to do the job. There certainly are some sites where the tremendous cost of cleaning up a relatively remote facility is going to present us with a very difficult set of choices. And of course, the contamination and the cleanup are all going to be paid for with taxpayer funds.
So, but there is some technology. There's some talk about bacteria that actually eat toxins, using robots, sending them out, I guess, into some of these areas and using them to clean up toxic waste, vacuum extraction. Is this all kind of pie in the sky stuff, or is this something with a will and with the money that could actually be used to clean up these toxic sites?
Well, all the techniques you've mentioned have some potential, with the exception of the bacteria eating the bioremediation, which is still a bit of a question mark, even though there's some pilot projects out there. But again, to my way of thinking, the technological problem is not the largest one here. I do discuss it to some degree in the book, but let me give you an example. One place I visited, and I discuss it in the book early on, is called the Jefferson Proving Ground. This is a 100-square-mile facility in southeastern Indiana, where since World War II, the Army has tested the vast majority of its chemical munitions, bombs, artillery shells, mines. Essentially what you have there now, after some 50 years of testing, is a 100-square-mile minefield. By the Army's estimation, they're not really sure, but there are anywhere between 1.5 and 7.5 million unexploded bombs and shells lying buried underneath the ground of the Jefferson Proving Ground. Now, the cleanup of such a site is going to be astronomically expensive. Some of these bombs and shells and mines are buried to a depth of some 30 feet below the ground. To clean this facility up, what they'd have to do is get armored vehicles and essentially strip mine the place down to a depth of some 30 feet. Can they do it? Well, theoretically, yes. It would probably cost billions of dollars to do that job. Will they do it? I think there's very little chance in the foreseeable future that that cleanup will be undertaken. What we see in the case of Jefferson Proving Ground is a base that's now slated to close within the next few years, with an astronomical price tag for cleanup, 100 square miles of beautiful farmland that has been taken over during these Cold War years and destroyed for the foreseeable future. We're going to see essentially the fence remain around Jefferson Proving Ground when the Army leaves, mm-hmm. and we'll just have to hope that people never forget about it and never manage to wander onto the site because the unexploded ordnance can go off at any time and does.
It's also teeming with wildlife. Does this undercut the danger of the area and how people even look at it?
Well, you know, it's one of the sad ironies of the facility that that we've made a kind of eerie wildlife preserve out there in Indiana. Aside from being blown up once in a while, the deer and bobcats and many other types of wildlife actually do pretty well with the absence of human interference. It's not a wildlife refuge that we can visit unless we want to take our life in our hands, and it's not one that most of us would be too happy to leave to future generations.
You visited military sites across the country only to discover that there were 19 suspected toxic sites 1 mile from your house. What are you doing about that?
In the course of, you're right, in the course of working on the book, I was on my way out to a facility, and I was told by an Army public relations person, well, gee, why are you going all the way out there? You have a very similar problem in your own community. And at the time, I had been doing a lot of traveling, and I really took it upon myself to find out what I could about my local problem. I entered into a very lengthy investigation of my local site. It took me some 3 months to get a hold of some of the basic information about it. My local facility is an Army base that's also slated for closure. Mm-hmm. And having researched this around the country, I was in a somewhat of a unique position. And so I published some of the material locally about what I had discovered in my own community.
And did that have an effect?
It did have an effect. The Pentagon sent a delegation of some 12 people to my little town council to try and refute some of the findings that I'd published. Thankfully for my research, they were relatively unable to refute them. And in the course of that, I think our town council has really gotten to be a lot more vigilant about the cleanup. They applied for funds from the Army to allow the town to have a technical advisor to help us to understand the complex environmental documents that were being issued during the course of the cleanup. The Army denied us that money, but we've managed to raise the funds ourselves. We're going to pay for that consultant anyway, because it's the feeling of our representatives that without that kind of technical expertise, we won't be able to understand what's going on or to be well served during the cleanup.
Is this a model you think that can be used for the rest of the country?
Well, I hope so. Yeah, I think that there's nothing to substitute for local involvement in the problem, and I think that people who live near military bases, and that includes very many people, would be well served by getting more acquainted with the problem.
Seth Schulman, thank you for joining us on Fresh Air today.
Well, thank you. I'm glad for your interest in the topic.
Seth Schulman's book is called The Threat at Home, Confronting the Toxic Legacy of the U.S. Military. This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne.